ghosts.
Hello, Ghostbusters.
They're real.
You do? You have?
They're here.
We got one!
Ghostbusters.
Hey, anybody see a ghost?
They catch the ghost that won't stay dead. They're armed. They're dangerous.
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
All right, that's bad. Okay, all right, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
They're professionals.
Oh. I'm the chairman of the largest paranormal removal company in America.
You see it?
They're all that stand between you and the end of the world.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the sky.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Your girlfriend lives in the corner penthouse of Spook Central.
You want this body?
Is this a trick question?
Got your stick?
Hold! Give up!
Smoke it!
Make him hard! Ready!
Ghostbusters. Starring Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Harold Ramis, Rick Moranis. Coming to save the world.
Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters.
We came, we saw, we kicked it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dan Aykroyd Podcast. I am your host, Scott White, and I have a guest that has not been on in quite some time. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Meredith Nudo, and the fact that I'm here proves that death threats to Scott work.
Yes, they do. What I did was, we did Ghostbusters 2, and then we did the pilot episode of the real Ghostbusters cartoon, and then we did Casper, which had Dan guest starring and did a cameo as Ray Stantz.
With a mustache.
With a mustache. And the last podcast, when this comes out, we're going to probably be in February. So if you're listening to this right now, well, you know what time it is, but we're recording it in December, but this is going to come out sometime in February. But the last podcast of 2023 was a rerun that Meredith and I did called The Gift of Winter, which was a Christmas cartoon. And actually, that was the very first IMDb credit for Dan and Gilda Red.
Oh, today I learned.
And every time we did a podcast, Meredith, like, when are we going to do Ghostbusters, the original? When are we going to do Ghostbusters? So we're doing Ghostbusters, the original.
Yay! Finally. I have been begging since the beginning of this podcast to let me.
You have been begging. So this podcast is actually going to follow the Blues Brothers. So the Blues Brothers is coming out in January, and this is going to come out in February. And I would say the Blues Brothers and Ghostbusters are Dan's two biggest movies and his two most iconic characters.
I would agree.
As I mentioned in the Blues Brothers podcast, it's very rare that somebody has two iconic characters that are just in pop culture. And Dan has that with Elwood Blues and Dr. Ray Stantz from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with you on that.
So where did you first discover Ghostbusters? I saw this in the theater, and you're much younger than I am. So where did you first discover it?
Yeah, I'm actually younger than the movie, even.
Yes.
So, obviously, and I believe that I said this in the Real Ghostbusters episode, my first exposure to Ghostbusters was the cartoon. So it was reversed for me. I saw the cartoon first, and then I think later on my dad was like, wait, what? There's a cartoon? Oh, psh, you need to see the movie. Because my dad was a really big fan of Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis' comedy. So then we watched the movie. And I loved it. Oh, and Rick Moranis. My dad loved Rick Moranis.
Yes, those are all Second City people.
Yep, and my dad was a really big fan of Second City, so it makes sense.
Did your view of Ghostbusters change? Because up until that point, all you knew was the cartoon. how did it change when you saw the original?
It was, how did it change? Not over much. I think I was extremely confused as to why Egon wasn't a blonde. And then later on, I found out that it was a likeness rights thing. But watching the movie, I was like, yeah, this tracks.
Yeah, Egon in the movie wasn't a blonde and he didn't have a rat tail.
Yeah, that I think was the most confusing part of all.
We're both big fans. I rewatched it yesterday. I watched it twice, actually, and I watched it once straight through, and then I watched it again with the audio commentary with Ivan Reitman and Harold Ramis. It was, bittersweet hearing Harold Ramis.
Oh, I'm sure.
On the audio commentary.
Now, I haven't listened to the audio commentary, so I can't speak to that, but you obviously go ahead and add some things in here.
I definitely will. One thing I will say about the audio commentary is putting it together from the bits and pieces. They said it was about the turn of the millennium. So it was obviously around 1998, 1999 when they did this audio commentary. And we all know that Harold Ramis and Bill Murray had that giant falling out on Groundhog's Day, which was in 1993. And I will say this, I am very impressed that Harold Ramis had nothing bad to say about Bill Murray. This was like 6 or 7 years into their feud, and he had nothing bad to say.
Even light of now, where, like, Bill Murray is getting kicked off of projects because he's so hard to deal with.
But
so
like I said, I give Harold Ramis 100% credit. He never said anything bad about Bill Murray. Everything he said in the on the audio commentary was positive and uplifting.
But he has every right to still say mean things about Bill Murray. I hear that Bill Murray is, like, horrible to work with.
Well, I hear like him and Chevy Chase, they're always compared. Yeah. Chevy Chase gets more of a bad rap about that than Bill Murray. But yes, Bill Murray is notoriously hard to work with. He was on just getting him to be on this movie was notoriously hard. As I'm sure you know this when Dan wrote this movie, it was supposed to be for him and John Belushi.
Yeah.
But John died. And so it went to
that puts a damper on things, yes. But from what I understand, Slimer was supposed to be their homage to John.
It was, yes, it was, and that was in the commentary. That is 100% true. That was their homage to John Belushi, Slimer, and pretty much the character he played in Animal House. He's just a party animal that liked to have fun. So
that was actually another difference between the cartoon and the movie. Was Slimer was a lot grosser. So, because you were seeing him from two dimensions and then to three dimensions, so it's nastier. The grotesqueness of him is much more tangible. And God, do I love the puppetry in this movie, and the practical effects. They hold up so well.
They hold up so well, and they
it
make
looks the, amazing.
And it makes the computer generated effects look so bad. And I know it's 1984, and they work with what they had, but there's always this debate going on right now. Against practical, against computer-generated effects. And the practical effects, like you said, in this movie are wonderful.
See, here's how I see it. I feel like, why is there a debate between practical versus computer when we've seen so many times before that combining the two really yields the best results? Look at the original Jurassic Park and how it was both animatronic and computer. They used the computer to kind of fill in the issues that you would have with animatronic and vice versa. And it still looks fantastic. So, I mean, in my mind, in the practical versus computer debate, it's why not both at the same time? It looks fantastic.
I'm sure it has to do with money. I'm sure it has to do with money. Yeah.
Billion-dollar corporations, they've got the money. They're just not spending it. And I think that's very silly. But that's a debate for a completely different podcast where I have a lot of opinions in all caps.
But speaking of special effects, this movie starts off with some awesome special effects in the New York Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
Where this little old library worker, she's down in the depths of the New York Library. And it's just very simple. She's walking down this aisle and the books move from one shelf to another. And it's very simple and it's very effective.
It's an iconic sequence for a reason, because it looks great.
Yes.
It looks great. It has excellent flow. One thing that I really like, too, is the ghost librarian just going, shh.
Yes.
It's so great. It looks so great. I love it. I love everything about this sequence.
Well, yeah, and then when she walks past the card catalog and the card catalog, oh, man, if anybody's younger watching this, they're not going to know what that is, but all the cards go flying out of the card catalog when she walks by. And in the audio commentary, Harold Ramis said that the only thing that sucked about that was picking up the cards and putting them back for multiple takes. They had to do multiple takes of that. So every time it was like, okay, cut. They picked up the cards, put them back in, and they had to do it all over again. And then she runs into something. At this point, we don't see it. She yells. There's this big gust of wind, and then we get the Ghostbuster logo. We don't get any lyrics, but we get the music from Ray Parker Jr.'s Ghostbusters.
I love that song.
That was the top song of that year.
As well it should be. As well it should be. It's very good.
I actually did a podcast on that video.
Oh, nice!
There was a legal battle. So apparently Huey Lewis...
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, Huey Lewis did a song that was close to that, and Huey Lewis sued Ray Parker Jr. and won, but there was a gag order, and Huey Lewis broke the gag order, so Ray Parker Jr. sued Huey Lewis and won. It's just very convoluted, yes.
And I love Huey Lewis, too, so this is it's a very...
That's tough, yeah, that's when your parents are fighting. Mom, Dad, don't fight!
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, how can you pit two kings against each other?
Then we cut to Bill Murray, and it's just written in red. It has, you know, Dr. Venkman, Dr. Stance, you know, Dr. Spangler, but written in red. It looks like in lipstick. It's like Dr. Venkman, burn in hell. And we walk in, we go in, and it's Bill Murray, and he's doing shock treatment tests on a male student and a female student. And this is something that would not fly today, I don't think.
I mean, it should not have been able to fly back then. It was pretty gross. But at the same time, like, it still fits the character. So,
it
like,
fits the character. This opening sequence.
He's gross. And I think part of the reason why it didn't bother me over much is the fact that it's not portrayed as okay. It establishes him as a kind of a shitty person.
So he's got a male and a female student, and he's holding up the cards. And it's like, if you guess what the card is, he doesn't shock you. But if you don't guess, he does shock you.
Right.
And the guy is getting him right, and he's still shocking him. And the girl is getting him wrong, and he's not shocking her.
Yeah.
And he's just doing this to...
Yeah.
Because
he's not...
To get in her pants. That's why he's doing
this.
Yeah,
because he's not a good scientist. He's not an ethical scientist. And that establishes very early on that he's just deeply unethical in his work. It's an establishing character moment. Like I said, it's not portrayed as this is okay. The laughs come from the fact that, wow, this guy's audacity. So it doesn't bother me.
Not only unethical, but he's just as somebody's going to point out later, he's just a poor scientist. And then Ray busts in and is like, we got to go to the library. You know, there's something happening at the library. And from what I've gathered, it's like 85% of Bill Murray's lines were ad-libbed. He just didn't stick.
Yeah, I could see that.
He just didn't stick. But just the banter between all three of them is just, it's just fantastic. You know, they're walking into the library and he's like, oh, you remember I witnessed that sponge migration. He's like, Ray, the sponge has migrated a foot and a half.
Honestly, that's still something to be excited about. I don't know. I really like Ray a lot. Because I love his enthusiasm about everything.
Ray has the child. Yeah, Ray has the childlike wonder of the group.
I think Egon does too, but he's not as he doesn't have the same mannerisms about it. But like the fact that he collects mold, spores, and fungi, that is awesome. That's an awesome collection. I would love to have him talk to me about his collection of mold, spores, and fungi because I like those things. And even though I'm not a paranormal investigator and I'm not really much of a believer in that kind of thing, I love listening to people like Ray who get really excited about it. Like, I don't really believe in astrology, but I have friends that do. And I could listen to them talk about it for hours, even if I'm not a believer, just because their enthusiasm for it, their breadth of knowledge and their joy in it is so infectious. So, like, That's why I really hate listening to anybody like that.
Do you remember? We had a. Do you remember Chad from improv? Chad Minshew.
Of course, I love Chad. Chad, if you're listening to this, I love you.
Chad loves the Oakland A's, which is a baseball team, and it was like it was just one day talking to him. He went to an Oakland A's. He went to an Astros game where they were playing the A's, and just how he was talking about it, he was just so excited. And I'm not an Oakland A's fan, but just hearing him talk about it, I got excited. So I totally understand what you're talking about. When somebody is very passionate about what they like and they're sharing it with you, it is very infectious.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why Ray always just made my little happiness heart go doki doki, because he's just a really, really fun character. And from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't Dan Aykroyd's dad a paranormal investigator in real life?
Ooh, that I don't know.
Only we had the internet.
We could probably look that up. They come into the library and Egon is there. They interview the librarian who runs into it.
Oh, you're here.
Yeah, what does he got?
This is Big Peter. This is very big. There's definitely something here.
Egon, this reminds me of the time you tried to drill a hole through your head. Remember that?
That would have worked if you hadn't stopped me.
I'm Roger Delacorte. Are you the man from the university?
Yes, I'm Dr. Brinkman, Dr. Stance, Egon.
Thank you for coming. Hope we can clear this up quickly and quietly.
Let's not rush things. We don't even know what you have yet.
I don't remember seeing any legs, but it definitely had arms because it reached out for me.
Arms? I can't wait to get a look at this thing. Alice, I'm going to ask you a couple of standard questions, okay? Have you or any member of your family ever been diagnosed schizophrenic, mentally incompetent?
My uncle thought he was Saint Jerome.
I'd call that a big yes. Are you habitually using drugs, stimulants, alcohol?
No.
Just asking. Are you, Alice, menstruating right now?
What has that got to do with it?
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
Vinkman is the ultimate con man. You think, why does Ray and Egon need Vinkman? But they need him because they are so analytical that they need somebody who can work in real life. If you understand what I'm saying. It's like, Ray and Egon would not, they'd get taken advantage of left and right because they're just so involved in the world. They need somebody who knows how the world works, and that is Vinkman.
They needed Vinkman's people skills.
Yes.
And actually, Peter Aykroyd Sr., who is Dan Aykroyd's father, has published a book, A History of Ghosts, because the family has a historic, I'm kind of paraphrasing off of Wikipedia here, but Wikipedia, just looking at the sources, it's pretty legitimate sourcing. So, the whole family has been involved in the spiritualist movement. So a lot of what Dan Aykroyd was talking about was, you know, does stem from his family history. Which I love. I love that. I mean, that's, from what I've understood, a lot of the techno babble that he uses in the movie is pretty accurate to spiritualism and ghost hunting, which I think is fantastic.
Oh, yes. He definitely researched it.
If not actually practiced it. I mean, like I said, it runs in the family. So, I mean, it's possible. I would go to a seance if I was invited, even though I'm a non-believer. I'm still curious, you know?
The thing with Dan is, it's like Dan wrote The Blues Brothers and he wrote this. Both of his original scripts, John Landis, who directed The Blues Brothers, and Ivan Reitman, who directed Ghostbusters, said these scripts are great, but they're unfilmable. And so John Landis edited, you know, and helped write Blues Brothers, and then Harold Ramis came in and edited and helped write The Ghostbusters. So Dan's ideas are out there, but they had to be reined in. And that's where these co-writers came in to shape Dan's work.
And I mean, sometimes we need that.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Like you said, he is a fantastic ideas guy.
Yes.
Fantastic ideas guy. I love the high concept stuff that he brought to Ghostbusters and Blues Brothers. I really miss super high concept movies like this. The fact that Everything Everywhere All at Once did so well gives me hope that in the future we'll get more just really weird stories made with love.
Or at least original stories, yes.
This is a weird story made with love, and that's why I love it. Like,
absolutely.
I have seen this movie 100,000 million times, and also I want to talk about Ernie Hudson.
We will talk about Ernie Hudson on my other podcast, which is More Gooder. I just did one on a Psych episode where Ernie Hudson was in it, and I have nothing but praise for Ernie Hudson. I love Ernie Hudson.
I have a lot of very positive things to say about Ernie Hudson, too.
One thing is that he doesn't age. We talked about the latest Ghostbusters with him, Dan, and Bill, and how he looks great, and Dan and Bill look like they're ghosts themselves. It's like, wow.
So, now, see, the only new Ghostbusters that I have seen is the 2016. I have not seen the two sequels, mostly because I was a bit scared to watch them. Mostly because I don't know. I'm weird about sequels. It's not that I'm anti-sequel. Like, the sequels to both of the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure sequels are incredible, because I love Bill and Ted. I think that maybe a Pass the Torch kind of sequel is going to be a harder sell for me.
But we're not here to talk about that movie. We're here to talk about the original, the one that started it all.
Classic!
So we were walking in they're down in the basement, and they ran into the ectoplasm, and that is food preservative. That's what Harold Ramis said. That's the ectoplasm.
I love that.
Is food preservative. And they ask Venkman to get a sample, and he gets it all over his face and his fingers, and he's like, yeah.
He slimed me.
And then they walk, and there's these books just stacked up, and then Bill Murray, yeah, you're right, no human being would stack books like this. Bill is the consummate skeptic. Egon and Ray, it's like this, you know, they're all four ghosts, and once again, Venkman is, you know, he's the skeptic. He has to keep them in line until they go around the corner and they actually see the ghost, which looks great. That's a great effect.
My cold dead heart is just so happy with these special effects.
They're like, what do we do? We should talk to her. And they sit, and of course they send Bill out, and, you know, where are you from? Originally. And like you said, then she just go, shh. And they're like, okay, that didn't work. And then Ray's like, I have a plan. All right, get her! And they run towards her, and then she turns into a demon. They all get scared and run out of the library. And that's just a fun scene. I don't know if they were able to, this was just circumstance or whatever, but they run out of the front of the library, and there's a bunch of pigeons. So when they run down the stairs, all these pigeons fly up, and it's a great effect. And I don't know if that was just planned, or if that just happened by circumstance, you know,
I don't know, because I could see it happening either way, because New York and pigeons.
Yep. And now they're all walking back to the college. They're all college professors. Egon has figured out that they have a chance to actually catch a ghost. And when Bill Murray, Venkman, hears this, the wheels start turning, because he's always thinking of the next thing. And he's like, so what you're saying is we could actually catch ghosts. Egon's like, yes. So now, you know, Peter's like, okay, we could go into business. Well, actually, it comes in later. They get back to the college, and they are getting thrown out of the college. They're, you know, the college is tired of paying for it. And right here, the Dean Jagger, I believe it is.
Yeah.
Dean Jagger just tells us what we all think about Peter Venkman. He's like, your theories are half-hearted. Your conclusions are not scientific. And he basically goes, you are just a poor scientist. And he is. Oh, this is one of those scenes where he's supposed to be the bad guy, but he is 100% correct.
Yeah, I feel 100% like that about correct. Walter. I feel like that about Walter Peck, too, which I'm sure we'll get into later.
Yes.
Where, like, maturity is understanding that in a lot of ways, Walter Peck was right.
He was.
We'll get into that.
We will
get
into that.
He's a dick about it, but he's not wrong.
And so they get thrown out of the college, and Bill Murray's like, okay, we're going to go into business for ourselves. And Ray's like, what we need is going to cost us a lot of money. And to me, they're both sharing this bottle of booze, and they're drinking back and forth. And Ray's like, God, the containment center we need is going to cost us a lot of bread. Where are we going to get it? And Bill Murray just looks him right in the eyes and goes, I don't know. Those are just perfect lines. The line, it's just, perfect comedic performances in this movie. There are so many quotable lines. It's been a while since I've watched it, and when I watched it again, I forgot just how quotable this movie is.
Oh, I mean, I have friends that are massive, 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 massive Ghostbusters fans. So we quote it regularly to one another.
Well, they end up...
I'm very partial to That's a Big Twinkie.
One thing I forgot about this movie is all the smoking. Everybody smokes in this movie, especially Aykroyd. He's a chain smoker in this movie, but Ernie Hudson smokes, and Dan smokes, and Bill Murray smokes a lot.
Well, you know, busting ghosts is hard. You gotta do something to relax. And it was the
well,
80s.
That's it. So.
So.
But Harold Ramis did not smoke, but his thing was junk food, because earlier, you know, Peter gives him the Crunch Bar earlier, and you know that Twinkie was his. With all the smoking going on with the other three, Harold Ramis's was junk food.
Yeah, just displaces the smoking with sugar.
Yes. And,
that's healthy.
But that being said, this was not supposed to be a kid's movie. This was supposed to be an adult movie.
Oh, yeah, but my dad showed me age-inappropriate movies all the time.
Right, but kids love this movie. And they were shocked. Oh, yeah. They were shocked that kids love this movie. So when they did Ghostbusters 2, which you and I did a podcast on.
Yeah.
They took out the smoking. So nobody smokes. If you go back and watch Ghostbusters 2, nobody smokes in Ghostbusters 2.
I'm sure you're correct. I just haven't watched it recently. I think the last time I watched Ghostbusters 2 was for our podcast. Because usually when I want to watch a Ghostbusters, I just watch the original.
You just watch the original. Yes. But when Ghostbusters 2 came out, no smoking. So all the smoking was taken out. Not taken out, but it wasn't written in. Because they were shocked at how many kids love this movie.
There's a lot to love about it. Like I said, I first saw it when I was a small child. And I mean... Like I said, my dad let us watch a lot of age-inappropriate stuff. I think we watched Stripes when I was a child.
Stripes is a great movie.
Groundhog Day. Like, we watched a lot of those SCTV folks movies when we were tiny. And, my big thing, I love Mr. Stay Puft. Mr. Stay Puft is probably the reason why I love kaiju movies as an adult. Like, I went as Mr. Stay Puft for Halloween one year. And I got a little, I found a little Dan Aykroyd doll that I carried with me. So, you know, and I would step on it for photos and things. And just really, really love Mr. Stay Puft. And I think that's why, because there's a lot of playful imagery in it.
Yes. Well, there is. And there's some legitimately scary parts in this movie.
Yeah. But it's mitigated by being a horror comedy.
Yes.
Not just a straight up horror.
No, no. This is definitely
horror,
comedy, sci-fi. Yes.
Yeah, which I love. I love the combination of horror, comedy, sci-fi. Any of those three things in combo, I am going to be a sucker for. Especially horror, sci-fi.
So they get the money by putting a third mortgage on Ray's house. And now they go to the famous firehouse. Egon and Venkman are talking. What do you think? And Egon's like, well, it's structurally it's structurally poor. The wiring is insufficient for what we need. We're in a bad neighborhood. And then all of a sudden you hear Ray. He's like, does this pole work? And he slides down the pole. This place is great. We should stay here tonight. And once again, this the childlike exuberance of Ray just comes out, and Venkman and Egon know that they're not going to talk him out of it, so they end up buying this building.
There's office space, sleeping quarters, and showers on the next floor, and there's a full kitchen on the top level.
It just seems a little pricey for a unique fixer-upper opportunity, that's all. What do you think, Egon?
I think this building should be condemned. There's serious metal fatigue in all the load-bearing members. The wiring is substandard. It's completely inadequate for our power needs. And the neighborhood is like a demilitarized zone.
Hey, does this pole still work? Wow, this place is great. When can we move in? You gotta try this pole. I'm gonna get my stuff. Hey, we should stay here tonight. Sleep here, you know, to try it out.
I think we'll take it.
Good.
I feel like of all the Ghostbusters, I'm totally a Ray. What about you? Probably. I think you're more of a Venkman.
I'm more of a Venkman.
You're less creepy to women. I've seen you act around women and behave around women, and you're not as much of a freak. So you're like a less creepy Venkman.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's my compliment to you. A less creepy for the Venkman. Holidays. For the holidays, that's my compliment to you, but I'm going to still go back to making mean comments.
Absolutely.
When it's not the holidays.
Then we see Ray pull up with the Ecto-1. It's not the Ecto-1 yet, but it's just this beat-up old car. Is that a hearse? What kind of...
I thought it was an old police car.
It's something. Yeah, you know what the Ecto-1 looks like. And he pulls up and he's like... And of course, Bill, you know, it's like, how much did it cost? $4,800. And that's in 84 money. And he's like, it just needs brake pads and, you know, it needs shocks and brake pads and this and that. And, you know, a lot of Dan Aykroyd speak in this movie.
Yeah, which is one of my favorites. I love Dan Aykroyd speak.
Love Dan Aykroyd.
I actually study the way he talks a lot for comedy's sake. Because I've had to play characters where they zip off a lot of technobabble really fast. And I will sit and just listen to Dan Aykroyd talk.
He does it with the best of them.
He really does. Like, I cannot anywhere near match him. So I'm not putting myself at his level. But I am saying that I do study him a lot comedically. If you play a lot of fast-talking characters, especially ones with technobabble, there's no one better to study. No.
Did you know that over 40% of Americans have a hard time swallowing pills? So when it's time to take your vitamins, large capsules and pills are out of the question. We know that gummy vitamins exist, but they're full of sugar, they get stuck in your teeth, and they only contain a fraction of the nutrients you need. Luckily, Easy Melts has discovered the ultimate vitamin sweet spot. Vitamins that melt in your mouth, taste like a treat, and are packed with nutrients ready for absorption, all without an ounce of sugar. For a limited time, Easy Melts is giving listeners a free 3-month supply of vitamin D3 with their first purchase. To claim your free D3 vitamins, visit try.easymelts.com/spring24. That's try.easymelts.com/spring24. Say goodbye to the old way of taking your vitamins and say hello to the easy way.
You know who else is very good is Jane Curtin. When they do the Coneheads together, Jane Curtin can do the fast babble just as well as Dan. She is fantastic as well.
I haven't watched as much Coneheads as I've watched Ghostbusters, though.
Oh, as it should be.
Have you done Coneheads for this?
I have. Yes.
Gotcha.
We're introduced to Sigourney Weaver for the first time. We see her. She gets out of a cab in front of her apartment. And Sigourney Weaver, I don't know why, I'm sort of obsessed with the height of actors. This is a tall cast. Bill Murray and Harold Ramis are 6'2". Dan Aykroyd is 6'1". And Sigourney Weaver is 6 foot as a woman. And Ernie Hudson are 6 feet. So
Why she's such a wonderful physical performer too, is because she really knows how to use her height to its fullest advantage. That's why she was as just iconic as she is as Ripley.
So she's wearing heels. She could be 6'3", 6'4", because it's always weird. It really stands out when they're in a scene with Annie Potts and Rick Moranis. I think Rick Moranis is like 5'4" and Annie Potts is like 5'3". So it's really funny because as we see Sigourney Weaver, she walks up to her apartment. And Rick Moranis comes out to meet her, who's her neighbor. And it's just very, very funny. He's 5'4", she's 6 feet. He obviously has a giant crush on her.
And another actor who knows how to use his height, or lack thereof, to his advantage. He is also another excellent, excellent, excellent physical performer. And the both of them, it's on full display here.
It is on full display. Now, that part was originally supposed to go to John Candy.
Really?
Yes. They wanted John...
Then he passed, or he wasn't able to do it?
He passed because he wanted to do it in a German accent. He had this weird take on the character. And Ivan Reitman was like, no, I don't want you to do it. And he eventually passed. And it went to Rick Moranis, which I think, no complaint there.
Yeah, especially because he's very, very, very much in the mold of Seymour from...
Little Shop of Horrors.
Little Shop of Horrors. Thank you. I love that movie. He's very much in that mold here, and he works so well in that, and I think that it works much better against Sigourney Weaver and what they were trying to do with the both of them.
Right. I think if
yeah,
it wouldn't have come off as innocent if John Candy was hitting on Sigourney Weaver, because John Candy is just this big bull of a man. It just, you think of Rick Moranis as, you know, he's just this 5'4" accountant, really nebbish. But if John Candy was hitting on Sigourney Weaver in this German accent, that would just be weird. It would just be off-putting.
It would kind of, even if it was not intentional, it would kind of play on like this creepy European.
Right, yes.
Thing, and it doesn't, like, he could have made it work if he wasn't being German, I think. Because John Candy, he's a really likable, affable guy, and I could definitely buy him, even if he's, like you said, a big bull of a man. I could still buy him as a kind of an oblivious sweetheart if he didn't do the German accent. I could. I could see it working. Because John Candy was a consummate actor, and he definitely could do the, aw, shucks. I don't think with the German accent it would have worked.
He wanted to have, he wanted to be this German, and then he wanted to have, like, two pit bulls with him, two dogs. And no, Ivan Reitman's like, well, we've already got the dog motif going at the end of the film. And it was just, they just couldn't get on the same page with the character. So John passed.
That is an awesome character for another movie.
He actually does that character in SCTV. There,
oh, okay.
Yes, he does it. If you're looking for what he was going for, there is actually a sketch on SCTV where he plays that character.
Okay, well, there you go. I think that's a great character. Mm. I just don't think it works in Ghostbusters.
You know, Sigourney sort of blows him. You know, he invites her. He's having a party in a couple of days, and he invites her, and she's like, well, maybe I'll stop by. And then she walks into her apartment, and her TV's on. And Rick Moranis goes, people were complaining that your TV was so loud. And she's like, oh, I didn't know I left it on. We go in, the TV is on, and we see the Ghostbusters commercial. It's one, you know, and they made it look like one of those cheesy commercials. We're ready to believe you.
And I love it. I love it so much. It makes me so happy.
If you notice in the commercial, when Egon steps forward to deliver his line, he looks down for his spot. And that was intentional. Yeah. It was like, because he's, you know, he's not an actor, he's a scientist. So you see him look down, walk onto his spot, and then his head comes up when he delivers his line. And that's it's very subtle, but also very funny.
Mm-hmm. It's the little details like that.
It's a little detail.
They, like I said, every actor and comedian needs to study this movie. Especially Ernie Hudson! Can we please talk about Ernie Hudson?
Ernie doesn't come in until about 45 minutes into the movie.
Okay.
And there's a reason for that. And once we get to Ernie, I'll explain. You might already know, but I'll explain to our listeners. She starts putting her food away, and then there's this great effect where she puts her eggs down next to a bag of Stay Puffed marshmallows.
Mm-hmm.
And the eggs start popping and cooking on the counter. And apparently they just heated the counter. It was just like an oven on the counter. But it worked. And it was something very simple, but it was just like very off-putting. I can't stress enough how these simple little tricks, just sometimes being extravagant works, sometimes these little, just one book traveling from, you know, on a wire. That's all you need to set the mood. These eggs just popping and cooking on the counter. That's all you need to set the mood. And then
I loved it so much.
And then she hears growling and she opens the refrigerator and, you know, and we get to see, was that Zool or was that Gozer? Was that Gozer saying the name Zool? I think it was Gozer saying Zool.
Maybe. I don't remember. I just knew it was the dog.
It was the dog. So she opens the refrigerator. This dog creature says Zool. And she slams it shut, and then we cut back to the Ghostbusters, and this is where we first see Annie Potts as the secretary, and it is just,
she's so great.
She's so great. So she gets there, and Bill Murray's is like, any calls? No, Dr. Venkman. Type something. Well, you were paying for this stuff. And he goes, don't look at me with those bug eyes. And I don't know if this is a turning point with his character, but he's like, you know, Janine, I'm sorry about the bug eyes thing. Yeah, so he's like, he apologizes for that. And
right, and it's probably a turning point because she's immune to him.
Once again, she is not like Ray or Egon. She's from the real world. One thing a bullshitter can see is another bullshitter, and I think, you know,
yep.
They both come from the same world. So, you know, they know each other's tricks. And so she's not falling for his stuff. You know, yeah. She's not naive at all. And we talked about this in this movie. She is like a no-nonsense New Yorker. She's not going to be pushed around. And she loses that in Ghostbusters 2. And she just sort of becomes a romantic damsel in distress character.
Which I really hate.
I really hate that. And I hated that hair, you know, whatever that Mo Howard hairdo that she had in number two. I don't know about that, but this is the Janine prototype.
Yeah, and that was another thing. That was another difference between the TV show and the movie too. Was like she was obsessed with Egon in the show.
In the audio commentary, they said they tried. It was, you know, they tried the romance between her and Egon, and Harold Ramis was like, it just never came together. In the movie.
Yeah, he just seems he's oblivious.
And then
I mean, honestly, if anyone was going to work with him, it would be Ray. If you're going to ship him with anyone, probably Ray.
Yeah.
But this isn't really a heavily romance.
No.
Movie anyway. Well,
I mean.
I mean, it has it, it but has it's not it. As heavy.
It's not that heavy. We have the Sigourney Weaver and Bill Murray, which happens now. So. Sigourney Weaver comes into their place and she walks in and she's like, I don't have an appointment. Bill Murray is in the back of the office and he hears her and you see his head pop up and he runs and he jumps over one of those low hanging doors that you walk through and he jumped over it. In the commentary, Harold Ramis goes, he barely made it over that. He almost tripped. And he goes, if he would have tripped and fell, he would have been pissed for the rest of the day. Because they called him One Take Murray. He's like, It was like one take and that's it.
I mean, look, as difficult as they say he is to work with, he does have talent.
No, absolutely.
But I can also understand why nobody would want to work with him. Like, I'm never going to be like, this should have been Bill Murray in a movie. Because I'm like, no, you probably didn't cast him for a reason.
So they say that, you know, Sigourney Weaver really wanted to do this movie because she wanted to do comedy. Because up to that point, she went to, I believe it was Yale Drama School. And she said, in her bio, she did a lot of comedies there.
Yeah.
Once you're kicking ass as Ripley.
Right.
So
she didn't want to be typecast.
Yeah, and she really wanted to do comedy. Now, and it's always, so she wanted to do comedy. On the other hand, Bill Murray, the only reason he did this movie is, he goes, if Columbia did a movie called The Razor's Edge, and that was the movie he did right before this, and that was a drama. So we always get this, where comedians want to do drama, and serious actors want to do comedy. And this is, like, both of them butting heads. So Bill Murray was like, if you produce my movie, The Razor's Edge, I'll do Ghostbusters. And Columbia agreed. And Razor's Edge was a huge flop. And, of course, Ghostbusters is now iconic.
That said, I have seen Bill Murray in dramas that are flowers.
No.
He was great in Broken Flowers.
He can act. He can do dramas. Definitely.
He just can't do Razor's Edge.
Now all three of them are interviewing Sigourney Weaver. She's got electrons on her head. It's like, well, she's telling the truth. And she's like, why would I lie? And, you know, people just looking for attention. And there's this really subtle scene where Bill Murray stands up and he looks at Egon and Ray and he does the help me out here, guys. It's like, there's certain things we do in this situation. You know, he's giving him like, what do you, you know, say something, make us sound professional. Ray and Egon, you know, I could look up the building, see if there's any paranormal activity been there. Bill Murray suggests that, okay, and I'll go back to Dana Barrett's. I'll go back to Dana's apartment and check her out. I'll go back out and, you know, and check out Dana Barrett's apartment. And they head back. He's got this machine. Well, he comes in and this apparently was all ad-lib, all this dialogue with him and Sigourney Weaver, where he starts doing the thing with the piano, starts playing the keys.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they hate this. They do. And then he's got that line, you know, he looks in the bedroom and she goes, that's the bedroom, but nothing ever happened in there. And he's like, what? What a crime. And she goes, you're not like a scientist. And the original line was, you're not like a scientist, you're more like a used car salesman. But apparently on the day of the shoot, Sigourney Weaver changed it to, you're not much of a scientist, you're more like a game show host. And they liked that line better, and they kept it in.
I like it better too.
Yes, actually. So Sigourney Weaver was ad-libbing with the best of them.
Yeah, I mean, because that's a dramatic actors can still do improv.
Oh, absolutely. They get into the kitchen, and there's this big dramatic moment where he opens the refrigerator, and he's just like, look at all the junk food. Obviously, Coke and Oscar Mayer, they paid to be in this movie, because you open it up, and Perrier water. So there's like Perrier water, and two cans of Coke, and Venkman actually takes this like Oscar Mayer salami, and like holds it up, and he's like, you eat all this stuff? So obviously they were all sponsors. They could not have used that without their permission. And I find it hard to believe that somebody would have Perrier and Coke in the refrigerator. I think if you're drinking Perrier, you're probably not drinking Coke.
That's not true. That's not true at all. They drink sparkling water and Coke in Europe.
Together?
No, but they still have it. Like they scratch different itches. They're both fizzy drinks, but one has sugar and one doesn't.
Well, you know, maybe because she did buy marshmallows, so evidently she does have a sweet tooth.
Yeah, but she's got to have the Perrier in there because it tastes good, and it's so she can be like, look, I'm healthy, I'm not drinking soda
every day. That's how you fool yourself. Oh, yeah.
I don't feel like that.
You have a bottle of Perrier, and it's like, oh, I'm drinking healthy. So you,
yeah, I don't feel like that's counter to anything. Like I have cider in my fridge, but I also have water and milk, you know. So what? I need dairy for big strong bones. I like alcohol in moderation, and I need water for hydration. I don't see anything perfectly unusual about any of that.
And there's this great interaction between them, where Bill Murray goes, I'm not getting any reading. And she goes, are you using it correctly? And it's like, well, and he sort of stumbles, but they keep it in there. He's like, well, I think so. But I know there's no animals in your refrigerator. And it's a very real line, because it, like, the line took him by surprise. I don't know if it was a ad-lib by her, but it took him by surprise. And it took him a second to get the right answer, but he did get it. And it just came off as very, very real. A real conversation between the two. And then he makes his move. They go back out into her living room. And then he confesses his love for her. And she's not having any of it.
Let me tell you something about myself. I come home from work to my place. And all I have is my work. There's nothing else in my life.
Dr.
I meet you. And I say, my God, there's someone with the same problem I have.
Yes, we both have the same problem. You.
I'm going to go for broke. I am madly in love with you.
I don't believe this. Will you please leave?
And then she threw me out of her life. She thought I was a creep. She thought I was a geek, and she probably wasn't the first.
You are so odd. No.
I've got it.
No, 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 no.
I'll prove myself to you.
It's not necessary.
Yeah, I'll solve your little problem.
Okay.
And then you'll say, Pete Venkman's a guy who can get things done.
Right.
I wonder what makes him tick.
I wonder.
I wonder if he'd be interested in knowing what makes me tick.
Right.
I'll bet you're going to be thinking about me after I'm gone.
I bet I am.
No kiss.
Once again, he can manipulate his students.
But not her.
But not her, because she's, you know, she is in the real world. He can manipulate his students. He can manipulate Ray and Egon. But once again, somebody who's been out in the world. I mean, she is a successful, she works for the symphony. So she is she's living on Park Avenue, for crying out loud. So she is a successful.
She's doing very,
very well
for herself.
Successful, independent woman. So she knows BS when she hears it. And she's like, okay, get out. And the scene just ends with her basically shoving him out her door, and the door closes, and then Rick Moranis, every time he hears Dana's door open, he pops out, and he hears her door close, and he pops out, and it's Bill Murray, but Rick Moranis always constantly locks himself out of his own apartment, so he's stuck in the hall while Bill Murray has to walk past him. And
it's great.
It is great. And then we go back to the firehouse, the Ghostbusters house, and they're all eating Chinese food. And Bill Murray's like, maybe I should take some money out of petty cash to wine and dine Dana, since she's our only client. And Dan points out, this magnificent feast is the last of the petty cash. So they're broke. They've used up all their money. And we see Janine, she's leaving for the day, and she gets a phone call. And it's just like, and I just love her. Hello, Ghostbusters. Of course, they're serious. It's like, really? And it's like, we got one! And she hits the bell. We get this great scene where the Ghostbusters slide down the pole. They're like firemen. They slide down the pole and they have, you know, their own lockers and they put on their Ghostbusting material, uniforms. And they get into the Ecto-1. This is the first time we see the Ecto-1 and it's all its glory. Looks great. And they pull up to this hotel and they unload the proton packs and they put them on. And one thing you'll notice is they only use the proton packs here and at the end. It's not like they overdo with the proton packs. You get a little nip of them in this movie. And they don't overuse it, which I think was very, 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 very smart.
Yeah, that was very smart.
You know, they walk into the hotel. Anybody see a ghost? We all know about the... You know, so they explain that there's a ghost on the 14th floor. They get into an elevator. And this might be... If it's not the funniest scene in the movie, it's right up there. We haven't tested out our proton packs. Egon turns on rays and you hear it start up. And Egon and Bill Murray, you know, Venkman, they try to get up. They're in an elevator and they try to get away from him, which is just hilarious. It's like they've got nowhere to go. It's like if that thing blows up, what are they going to do? And then we get, you know, they're...
Blow it all up with an unlicensed nuclear accelerator.
Right. And then they start walking through the hall. And this tells you what kind of, you know, Bill Murray is. Like, Ray is like a little kid playing with it. You know, he's got the, it's unholstered. I don't know. What would you call, you know, he's pointing the proton pack.
I would say it's holstered and then unholstered.
Okay, so he has it unholstered.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Murray has his holstered. And Ray is just like a little kid. He's like walking around. He's hunched down. You know, he's ready for any ghost. And Bill's just, I still at this point don't think, I mean, even though he's seen a ghost, He's not really invested in this because it hasn't made him money yet. You know, that's why he's so sort of nonchalant, I'm guessing, at this point. Like, he's in it for the... He's not, you know, Ray and Egon are in it for the experience. You know, Egon's always like, get me a specimen of that. And Ray's always childlike wonder. And Venkman is unimpressed with this venture because it hasn't made him any money yet. And that's the only reason he's in it, is for the money. The maid comes around the corner. You know, they shoot her cart. And it explodes. What the hell are you doing? Sorry. And the reaction is priceless. Sorry. Sorry. Sorry, we thought you were someone else. And it was just like, that's... They just play it off. It's like, and that's where Bill comes in, being the real world guy. It's like, sorry, ma'am. We're just exterminators. Just the banter between those three. And then they split up. Bill Murray has another great line. Maybe we should split up. He's like, yes, we can do more damage that way. We run into, the first one we run into is Ray. He comes around the corner, and this is the first time we see Slimer. And he's eating off a tray, so the food is going right through him. So he's eating it, and the food's just going on.
Then another really, really, really excellent visual, too.
It's great.
It's so nasty, and I love it.
Because, it's because he's like pressing the... plate again.
It's gross. Is it looks some? It looks semi-digested when it falls out of him, even if it's not really. I don't know. Is there some like acid to his body that kind of breaks it up just a little bit?
There might be. And once again, they never called him Slimer. They never called him Slimer on set.
Yeah.
They called him Onion Breath because apparently the sculptor smelled like onion. So they called it Onion Breath or they called it Baby Belushi, but they never called it Slimer. That just came out, that organically came out after, you know, the famous He Slimed Me line. But yeah. he was never given a name in the script. He was never named Slimer. That just was, this
right.
was something.
And see, going into the movie, having seen the cartoon first, he was always Slimer to me.
Right.
Even if he wasn't called that. I also expected him to play a bigger role in the movie.
Well, of course.
Just because he was the cute sidekick in the cartoon.
You know, he wasn't in the original script because Belushi was in the original script as the Venkman character. So after Belushi died, both Dan and Harold wanted to pay homage to him. So he was written into the script. The guy who sculpted him said he actually had a headshot of John Belushi and he tried to make, you know, he tried to capture the Belushi essence in Slimer.
It worked. Now, obviously, I found out later that it was meant to be John Belushi, but, like, it was very easy to see the connection between the two.
And it was all, you know, it was sort of based on his, you know, Bluto from Animal House.
Oh, yeah.
Dan does this.
Another age-inappropriate movie that I watched as a child. There's a theme.
Did you watch Caddyshack 2?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I watched all kinds of age-inappropriate movies when I was a kid. Like, that probably explains a lot.
We'll be back in a minute, back. Don't forget it, don't you go away. You better stay right there, don't you turn us off, cause there's no place else to go. But the show will be back in a minute, back. In a minute, back.
To support this podcast, please go to www.patreon.com/ScottWhite and give what you're able. If you're listening on iTunes, please give a review. That should help people find this podcast. And no matter what services you use to listen, please leave feedback. We always want to improve. Thank you for listening to the Dan Aykroyd Podcast.
Janine, any calls?
No.
Any messages?
No.
Any customers?
No, Dr. Venkman.
It's a good job, isn't it? Type something, will you? We're paying for this stuff. Don't stare at me. You got the bug eyes. Janine, sorry about the bug eyes thing. I'll be in my office.
Very handy, I can tell. I bet you like to read a lot, too.
Print is dead.
Oh, that's very fascinating to me. I read a lot myself. Some people think I'm too intellectual, but I think it's a fabulous way to spend your spare time. I also play racquetball. Do you have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Cross the Streams Media.
This has been a Cross the Streams Media podcast.
It's here.
A full torso apparition, and it's real.
So what do we do? Could you come over here and talk to me for a second, please? Could you just come over here for a second, please? Right over here.
Come here, Francine. Come here. What do we do? I don't know. What do you think? Make contact. One of us should actually try to speak to it.
Good idea.
Hello. I'm Peter. Where are you from? Originally.
Shh.
All right. Okay. The usual stuff isn't working.
Okay. I have a plan. I know exactly what to do. Now stay close. Stay close. I know. Do exactly as I say. Get ready. Ready?
Get her!